Welcome to the Broadway Radio Show. I'm Donald Feltham, and I am thrilled and delighted to welcome author Amy Spalding. Hi, Amy.
Hi, Donald. I am so excited to be here.
We have a mutual friend, David, who kind of put us together, and I'm kind of excited to have you on. I've had plenty of authors on the radio show, but as I was reading your book, I was realizing that you are the first author of a fictional novel to be on the Broadway Radio Show.
Oh my God, that's exciting.
It is exciting because usually I have, you know, authors who have come on written books about theater history, or they've written biographies. They're usually books about theater that are nonfiction. But you have written a book that's in the world of theater, but it is a fictional piece called In Her Spotlight. Which we're going to kind of get into depth to. But you're also here because you are going to play your 12 favorite show tunes as of this moment.
literally as of when I made the list. And, you know, we'll get into it. There's a few I sort of felt like I made concessions on because of track length.
Oh, well, you don't have to make concessions about track length, because we're very free form on this radio show.
Still, so. I sometimes feel like if you're like just being led through songs by someone, maybe you don't want a 9-minute track.
Very good point. But before we dive into your 12 favorites, and before we dive into this specific book, tell a little bit the listeners a little bit about yourself, where you grew up, and how you got interested in writing, becoming a writer.
Yeah, I grew up in St. Louis, Missouri, and I really always wanted to be a writer ever since I figured out that, like, the books I read, the TV shows I watched, it was someone's job to, like, come up with the stories. That was it for me. I was like, I'm in. That's what I want to do. And I feel fortunate that, like, my literal childhood dream has come true, that I've become an author. But we have all sorts of childhood dreams. Like, at some point, I think I wanted to be a dog trainer. That was not for me. I don't have the patience for that. So I think it's okay. I just want to say, if you have a childhood dream that didn't come true, that is also so okay. I feel fortunate that I had one that made sense that I was able to fulfill.
Mm-hmm.
So I, you know, sort of throughout my childhood, young adulthood, really worked at writing, never really took formal writing training. So I will say, if that's the path you go, it is valid. You will have to do a lot of work. I did so much reading. I did so much writing things that were very bad in order to sort of like eventually get somewhere that was better. Mm-hmm. So it was sort of like a long route for me. I was very Midwestern in that I was told, like, well, you can write, but you should have a day job that pays the bills. So like I got a marketing degree, not a writing degree. So I was, you know, I'm just someone who spent a lot of my free time growing up working at this thing, loving this thing. And I don't know, I feel really fortunate that eventually worked out.
Mm-hmm. And where did you go? Where did you go to college?
I went to college at Webster University in St. Louis.
Mm-hmm.
Because, again, I got a marketing degree, but they had a really cool program that was like communications and production based versus business school based. Mm-hmm. So a lot of what I was doing was actually like writing copy, coming up with strategy, collaborating with others, all sorts of things you actually end up doing as a writer. And it really like built that muscle. And I had professors who were literally like, hey, if you also write fiction or creative nonfiction, like you will learn so much that will be relevant to your career by doing this too. Mm-hmm. So the nice thing was I sort of felt like I was able to like sneakily get in all this writing training.
Mm-hmm.
If not like the MFA route, I still was right. Like, look, when you spend a lot of time talking about creative strategy and how to get your, you know, a point across very clearly and as few words as possible, that all, like, it all helps.
Yeah, exactly. And talk about when you, the ultimate move to getting your first book published. I mean, what was the transition and when did that happen?
So about a little more than 15 years ago, I thought I had to get really serious about writing because it was taking up a lot of my free time. And I felt like I was not really progressing at all. And I'd sort of done the same thing since I was like a teen, which was I would write something and I would be proud of it. And I would maybe show a few people and then I would like just move on to do something else. And I thought like, I didn't really know what came next. So I sort of gave myself 6 months to really research, like, how do you get an agent? What do agents want from people? How do you, you know, what do agents do? What is the next step? And so in doing that, I realized I wasn't really ready because I couldn't really... You're supposed to write this thing called a query letter where you explain sort of the hook of your book and comparing it to different things. And I just felt like a C. I was like, I don't know. And so I thought, well, I don't think it's, because if you can't say what your book's about, it may not be about anything yet. Uh-huh. So I ended up doing a lot of rewriting and went through the whole process, ended up getting a literary agent who is still my agent today, very easily. And it was an agent who had a lot of sales on her record, just like a dream person to work with. And I thought, wow, this was so easy. I guess I'm going to get a book deal like tomorrow. And unfortunately, that took like 3 or 4 more years. My first books were young adult novels for teens. And this was sort of when like vampires and dystopian were really mm-hmm. hot. And I'm just, you know, writing quiet stories about like girls and stuff they're going through. It's not vampires or the uh-huh. end of the world. And so it took a while to get my first book deal. And so my first book ended up coming out in 2013, which is coincidentally, it's a book called The Reese Malcolm List, which is, it's out of print now, but libraries still have it. You could still probably find it online used. But that also is set backstage during musical rehearsals in that one, which is about kids doing a production of Merrily. So.
Oh, interesting. That is very interesting. I did not know. I did not realize that. But how would you describe your current writing genre and what you focus on now?
Yeah, I say that I write sapphic romance because that's sort of the easiest way to sum it up. I have a series. And when I say series, don't be afraid. Like, read. You only read the fourth one. You were not confused by anything.
No.
So they're all standalones, but it's out in Hollywood. And mm-hmm. the idea is writing about queer women in the entertainment industry, but from sort of all angles. Mm-hmm. The newest book is about like an A-list actress, but there's a book about someone who works as, you know, a talent agency assistant. There's one about someone in marketing. There's one about someone who's dating like an actress, but more on the indie, you know, up and coming level. So right. I work, you know, my day job, I work in entertainment marketing and I have for about 2 decades. So I really, as someone who loves reading about Hollywood, but sometimes gets frustrated when I'm like, you've obviously never been here. I want to get this stuff right. I love just sort of like diving into like, you know, the backside of the industry. That sounds like the butt. But like the other side, the stuff,
right.
not the glamorous stuff. The like, what is it really like to work? And not like, I'm also not looking for like scandal or horrible things either. Just sort of like the day in, day out reality mm-hmm. of the right. entertainment industry.
Right. And just to tell people about the series, which you mentioned, is called Out in Hollywood series. The book titles are For Her Consideration, At Her Service, On Her Terms, and the newest one, In Her Spotlight, which
preposition, her noun,
yes.
is the series.
Yes.
Constructions.
The one I read, of course, is In Her Spotlight, which is kind of set in the world of theater, which we will delve into when we're going to take a little break. We're going to play 6 of Amy's favorites, and then we'll take a little break and talk about In Her Spotlight, and then we'll play the last 6 favorites. But the thing that I found interesting, because, of course, when I found out it was part of a series, I thought, oh, my God, I'm jumping into the fourth one. Am I going to understand what's going on? and as I read it, I'm like, well, this doesn't feel like it's the continuation of a series. It feels like it's a standalone. So I finished it and I loved it. It was really fun.
Thank you.
Because it is, it's very, how to describe it? It's a bit like a romantic comedy because it's got a lot of funny stuff happens, but there's some serious stuff that happens and it's very realistic. And it's very true to having grown up doing theater all my life. It's very true to what happens during the production and rehearsals of a show, because that's what it's set during. But
so glad to hear. I mean, I know we'll get into it more, but I'm so glad to hear that. That was, as someone who may complain sometimes about things set in Hollywood, I didn't want to write the thing set in theater and have the people complaining about me.
Right. But then it made me intrigued about the other 3 books, the previous mm-hmm. 3 books. And I quickly discovered that there's sort of this Amy Spaulding universe.
Yes.
There's sort of like this out in Hollywood universe because the other books have some of the same characters. There's characters that overlap because there's characters that pop up in this book that obviously are the focus, more of the main focus of some of the previous books, which I didn't realize. So now, of course, I'm intrigued to go back and read the other books.
Yeah, go back and read them
because
all.
Because I want to find out more about Max and Sadie and the other actress, and I don't want to give too much away, but there's characters in this book who are involved in much more major plot things in the other books. So I didn't, which I didn't realize, but it doesn't mean you can't skip around because they'll understand.
I always tell people, I'm like, if there's one that appeals to you more, read that. Or if you go to the bookstore or the library and they just have one, get whatever one they have, you will be fine.
Right.
But ultimately, yes, they are in order. There, it is a universe set over. I mean, I didn't do the math. A few years in Hollywood. And, you know, for like in the first book, I sort of seeded the idea of like the three stories of the other books. But if you're not looking for it, you wouldn't know necessarily.
Yes. Yeah. Because it didn't even dawn on me as I started reading. I said, oh, this is clearly not the continuation of previous books, even though I know it's book number four. But I didn't have a clue that the other characters were in the other books. So, I mean, these characters would pop up and I'd go, oh, this is a really fun character, or this is a really interesting character. And in some cases, I thought to myself, oh, I hope we get to learn more about some of these other characters in the book. And we don't, but that's because you've already actually covered some of the
exactly,
in the other
books.
And I was like, oh, now I have to go back and read a little bit more so I can understand a little bit more about this person because they're in the other books. And I was like, oh, man, this is... And so, of course, you hooked me because I'm like, I got to read out
great.
More.
Great. I love hearing it.
Yeah. And so, but I also want to point out the fact that even though it's not theater-based, you're not necessarily a stranger to being on stage yourself.
No, I've done... I used to do a ton of improv.
Yeah, I think that's fascinating.
Yeah, I did. I mean, I did a lot of improv for about a decade. And I think I feel like a lot of people, at least the ones I know, the ones I did improv with, I feel like a lot of us are coming into it on the younger side. And you spend a lot of time. I don't want to say it's a young person's game. It is not. But there's a lot of late nights. There's a lot of time involved. Mm-hmm. And at a certain point, I think in lives and careers, there's not always the time to hold doing it as much. But yeah, I studied improv. Actually, I was thinking about writing a book with some improv plot elements. And so I took a class as research and I ended up not writing that book. But I loved doing improv. And then I just was, you know, hooked, met so many close friends, some of whom I'm still, you know, very close to today.
Yeah.
So, yeah. And
it's really interesting. I've met a lot of people. I actually have a friend who works very closely with an improv theater company and here in LA. And I've also had other friends who've gotten interested in doing improv for who are in other careers and who've gotten interested in doing improv to kind of help them with their current career.
I really think everyone should do it. My therapist and I agree on this, actually. I found out, which I felt like very like, oh, I know something a therapist. I believe the same thing a therapist thinks, which is just like literally just taking like one improv class will teach you so much about active listening, about just like standing somewhere and having to like present information on the fly, about having to really collaborate to all the yes and stuff. And I really do think it just makes you like better at stuff in a way that is like a crash course in it that it would take you maybe a whole career to learn otherwise.
Yes. And interesting that you say that because one of my friends who was a big proponent of that is a therapist who actually went and took an improv class to kind of get a feel for it. And got hooked on it and is now doing improv himself.
I love that.
On the side, because he loves it so much. And he thinks it's such a useful tool. So there you go.
I always think about like, how would I like go through an author career if I hadn't done improv already? Mm-hmm. Because, you know, I'll sometimes be like in the green room before an event and people are nervous. People are worried about how they're going to go out and talk about their books. And I'm like, once you've spent years going on stage not knowing anything about what's about to happen, I can't think of something more comforting than going on stage and talking about a book I wrote where I know everything that happens
exactly.
And why I wrote it. Yeah, it's a lot easier.
Yeah, exactly. So we will, as I said, we will dive into In Her Spotlight very soon. But first, Amy, I would like you to take the reins, so to speak, and start talking about your 12 favorite show tunes. And where would you like to start?
All right. I'm like moving this tab over, actually, like so I can see like two things at once. Because as we, Donald and I discussed, the names of what albums are called can be tricky. They all have their own naming conventions, especially revival casts. So I want to make sure I'm getting them right. But I think we're going to start Wait, do you want me to say things about the songs before we start? Am I just enjoying the song? Okay.
Yeah. Yep.
We're going to start
Talk about why you picked the song and then we'll play it.
Yeah. So I will say overall, I'll say a few things, which is that I tried to pick songs from shows I truly love versus just songs I love, because there's a lot of good show tunes. Some of them are from musicals I think don't hold up. Mm-hmm. So I tried to really pick shows that I like start to finish. And I tried to pick the version that maybe I love the most or I listen to the most or I'm most excited about. So that's my general stuff. Let's start with a song from the new Broadway cast recording of Merrily We Roll Along. As I said, this was the backdrop of my very first book, The Reese Malcolm List. And I really fell in love with the show because I was spending time learning about it to write the book. And I think this is a show with a lot of cast recordings that I usually like two out of three of the main characters. And I think the new cast recording, that revival cast, is so great. I unfortunately didn't get to see it live, but I did watch the Fathom event, the filmed version. And this cast is great. It's nice to have just listened to an album where I think everyone is just who I would have cast. And I think the song's a banger. I think it's fun. And I think people who, when I was trying to describe Merrily to people who like did not know what it was, this was always a good one to start with.
So let's hear
Old Friends.
Yeah, we're going to hear Jonathan Groff, Daniel Radcliffe, and Lindsay Mendez from Merrily We Roll Along.
Hey, here's to us.
Who's like us? Damn few. Hey, old friend, are you okay? Old friend, what do you say? Old friend, are we or are we unique? Time goes by, everything else keeps changing. You and I, we get continued next week. Most friends fade, or they don't make the grade. New ones are quickly made, and in a pinch, sure, they'll do. But us, old friend, what's to discuss, old friend? Here's to us, who's like us, damn few.
So, old friend, fill me in slow. Old friend, start from hello. Old friend, I want the when, where, and how. Old friends do tend to become old habit. Never knew how much I missed you till now.
Most friends fade, or they don't make the grade. New ones are quickly made, some of them worth something too. But us, old friends, what's to discuss, old friends?
Tell you something, good friends point out your lies, whereas old friends live and let live.
Good friends like and advise, whereas old friends love and forgive.
And old friends let you go your own way,
help you find your own way,
let you off when you're wrong,
if you're wrong,
when you're wrong.
Right or wrong, the point is old friends shouldn't care if you're
should, but not for too long.
What's too long?
If you're wrong.
When you're wrong.
The thing is, old friends do leave their brands on you, but old friends shouldn't compete.
Old friends don't make demands on you.
Should make demands on you.
Well, don't make demands you can't meet.
Well, what's the point of demands you can meet?
Well, there's a time for demands, whether you meet
no,
them
you are never wrong.
Hey, old friends, how do we stay? Old friends, who is to say? Old friends, how an old friendship survives? One day chums having a laugh a minute. One day comes and they're a part of your life.
friends pour through the revolving door. Maybe there's one that's more, if you find one that'll do. But us old friends, what's to discuss, old friends? Here's to us, who's like us. Two old friends, fewer won't do. Old friends, gotta have two old friends helping you balance along. One braids you for your faults and fancies.
One persuades you
that the other one's wrong. Most friends fade or they don't make the grade. New ones are quickly made perfect as long as they're new. But us old friends, what's to discuss, old friends? Here's to us, who's like us. Damn few.
So we are with Amy Spalding, and she's doing her 12 favorite show tunes. And we just heard Old Friends from Stephen Sondheim from Merrily We Roll Along. And where are we going next? It's a musical that I know and love. I've had a few people pick songs from this, but I've never had anybody pick this particular song.
Oh, that's really interesting. I'm not surprised other people picked from the show, but talk about a song from Hedwig and the Angry Inch. I'm going to go back to the original cast recording, though I love every cast recording of this show. I love how piano heavy this one is. I love rock and roll played on piano. It just, as someone who grew up taking piano lessons, there's something where I was like, oh, I didn't know we could sound cool. I didn't know. And I picked Tear Me Down because I love the way the show opens. I think especially when the show, it just sort of feels like came out of nowhere in the 90s. Everyone was like, what even is this? And this is just, I love a good opening number that just like walks in and is like, here we are. This is what we're doing.
Right. And we're going to hear the creator of the show, John Cameron Mitchell, as Hedwig singing Tear Me Down.
Ladies and gentlemen, whether you like it or not, Hedwig!
Don't you know me? I'm a new Berlin Wall, baby.
Remember one thing! Listen, he must difference between a bridge and a wall.
Without me right in the middle, babe.
So we are with Amy Spaulding, and Amy's doing her 12 favorite show tunes. And where are we now, Amy?
We are now going to depart to one of the exceptions you let me make, because I was supposed to pick only from cast recordings.
Well, you can pick. You're not really too far off the exception list, because as long as it's a stage show, it's
fine. Yes. But this is my... we're going to talk about a song from Little Shop of Horrors, which is one of my favorite movies of all time and one of my favorite stage shows. I love that they're different. But the thing about it as a movie, as someone who writes romantic comedy, is this is sort of the thing about the Little Shop movie. It's sort of a romantic comedy where the conflict between them is a man-eating plant. And because it has a happy ending, unlike the stage show, spoiler alert. And I really just love it. And again, I love every version. I have seen this show on stage a million times. I've watched the movie more times than I can count. If you put it on a big screen near my apartment, I will drive and watch it again. So to me, it is my favorite version of it. I love Rick Moranis. I have a tattoo. You can't see it because I'm wearing a sweater, but I have a tattoo of Ellen Green and Rick Moranis on my arm.
Oh, my God,
Audrey,
really?
And Seymour.
Oh, wow.
So this is, I would have, if you said I really couldn't pick a soundtrack, I would have survived. But obviously, this is the cast for me. So, and I love Skid Row because, as you'll see from some other songs on this list, I love a song that sort of takes you through a whole thing. You're getting chorus members, you're getting a setting, you're being taken through the lives of people. Then you're like diving down, getting super specific. You know, it's Howard Ashman's lyrics are incredible. You're starting out with like jokes, and by the end, you're getting like existential life demands. So, man, I love this song.
Down, down, where the hop heads fuck in the snow. Down on Skid Row. One time you cater to a million jerks. Come on, time you mess and jerks and narrow parts. Meeting by a lunch is at the hot dog hearts. The person that your money and they bring your hearts. And by the time you cater to a million jerks. He tells me, gee, I'm not sure. Sweep that floor, kid. Oh, I started life as an orphan, child of the street, here on Skid Row. He took me in, gave me shelter, a bed, crust of bread, and a job. Treats me like dirt, calls me a slob, which I am. So I live
downtown.
That's your home address, you live
downtown.
When your life's a mess, you live
downtown.
Where depression's just status quo.
Down on Skid Row.
Someone show me a way to get out of here. Cause I constantly pray I'll get out of here. Please won't somebody say I'll get out of here. Someone give me my shot or I'll rot here. Show me how and I will, I'll get out of here. I'll start climbing uphill and get out of here. Someone tell me I still could get out of here. Someone tell Lady Luck that I'm stuck here. Gee, it sure would be swell to get out of here. Bid the gutter farewell and get out of here. I'd do heaven and hell to get out of Skid. I do, I don't know what to get out of Skid. But a hell of a lot to get out of Skid. People tell me there's not a way out of Skid.
So we just heard from the original motion picture soundtrack of Little Shop of Horrors. We heard Rick Moranis, Ellen Green, and the cast doing Skid Row, also one of my favorite movie musicals. I think they did a fantastic job translating it to the screen, even though they demanded it have a happy ending tacked on. Although they did film the bad
yes.
ending, and you can see, and you can kind of see the rough cut of it on like the extended version on the Blu-ray, which is really, really fun.
It's so fun that it still exists. And
yeah.
One time I did see it once on screen where they played the original version, despite that it was, you know,
yeah.
not really fully finished. And that was a lot of fun to see with an audience because it is wild.
Yeah, it's really wild. And I actually really like the additional song that they added.
Yes.
Mean Green Mother from Outer Space. It's
yeah.
It perfectly fits the show. So,
it is such a, you know, a lot of adaptations struggle in some way or another, but I think mm-hmm. the Little Shop one, I mean, the Hedwig one too, I just think.
Yeah. Well, that's how I first saw Hedwig, was as the movie.
Me too. Yeah.
Yeah. And I was blown away by it. But,
same.
You know, I think also because it was done as an independent film and very low budget. And I mean, I think I had heard of the musical, but had never seen it. And then I saw the movie and was like, oh my God, this is like, knocked me off my feet.
I was blown away. But I remember there was like at one point I just like wanted to stand up and start yelling, like, how is it this good? I could not handle how much it blew me away. It was like after the trailer, after the like trailer blows apart at like the end of like Wig in a Box, where it like, you know, like the walls come down and mm-hmm. it's just like, oh my God, I lost
yeah.
my mind. I was like, yeah. what?
And I thought, you know, this musical is not geared to me because I'm like a real Broadway kind of person and the music is not going to be my style and whatever. And then I got to see it and I was like, this is musical theater.
Yeah.
It's rock, but it's musical theater. And he knows how to write. This guy knows
yes.
how to write, you know.
And like how to tell a story.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. Yeah. Anyway, so now we're going to go back to a little bit more traditional musical theater.
Yes, I contain multitudes.
Yes, exactly. So where are we next?
Oh, we're going to do a song from one of my favorite musicals of all time, Ragtime. And Ragtime is a show I've seen a lot. I saw the original Los Angeles cast a bunch out here. And I've seen it on tour multiple places. I didn't see I know there was another revival, but I just saw this revival late last year at the Lincoln Center. And I cannot believe how wonderful it was. Ragtime is a show that I do think if you just put people in it who can sing, it's going to be good. But knowing how special that original cast was, the original Broadway cast and the original cast I saw in Los Angeles, I was unprepared for how much I would fall in love with this new cast, this new production. And I think there's something really special about loving something for a long time and getting to see a new version and like having a new experience with it. Mm-hmm. It just felt really, really beautiful. And one thing I like about this current production is it definitely seems, it's real different watching Ragtime in 2025 when I saw it last year than when I originally saw it in 1997. I'll just say, you know, politically, et cetera, maybe mm-hmm. we're in like slightly different place. But I love that the show never felt heavy handed about that. I never felt like they were like looking at us like, get what we're saying here. It's just like a really, I felt like a graceful, really beautiful production. And so I wanted to play a song from that. I could pick just about every song in Ragtime, but I went with new music because like I feel about Skid Row, I feel like this is a song that starts with, you know, one thing, it leads to bigger things. It has like one of the best, you know, sort of dramatic crescendos I've ever seen within a song, within a show. And I mean, I have cried listening to this track at home a million times. I've cried seeing it on stage. I love the song so much.
Well, get your tissues out because we're going to hear from the new Broadway cast recording of Ragtime. We're going to hear the cast singing new music.
Where have I been? How did we change? Caught in this strange new music. Say, was I away too long?
Just like that tune, simple and clear, I've come to hear
new music.
Why can't you hear the song?
And every note says please, and every chord says turn my way.
I thought I knew what love was, but these lovers play new music, haunting me and somehow taunting me. My love was never as true. And I ask myself, why can't I sing it too? Has changed, Sarah. You gotta see, Sarah. We got a son, Sarah. Come down to me.
You and your music singing deep in me, making. Something so new, changing.
So I believe we are going to continue with another period piece. And yes. also another kind of lengthy multi-cast character song that's also telling a very big story. And that is also another Sondheim musical. And what, yes. What do we have next?
We have A Weekend in the Country from A Little Night Music, one of my favorite songs. I like having the song on in the car. I like singing the parts. I like if people are around forcing other people to sing different parts. I think A Little Night Music is, I don't want to say it's an underrated Sondheim show. No one is walking around saying A Little Night Music isn't a great show, but it's so great. And I feel like it's not often the one talked about. I think it is so funny. There are lines and lyrics, there are lines in the book that make me laugh every single time. And I think A Weekend in the Country is, you know, it's also beautiful. I laugh at things. I think actors really get a chance to do some big stuff. But also, as always, like just beautiful melody, beautiful lyrics.
Right. I agree. I think it's one of my, I think it's to me one of my top two. When it comes to Sondheim musicals, it's
same.
It really is. It's a very adult. It's like it's sort of like an adult sex comedy in a way.
Yeah, it's super. I mean, that's the thing I love about it is, you know, it's a period piece. It's very beautiful. It looks a certain way, but it's also just a show with a bunch of goofy sex jokes in it. And I'm like, great, let's do it.
It is because if you dressed it up and made it a modern piece, it would be. It would be a sex comedy. It really
absolutely.
Would. I mean, it really would.
It's my favorite thing about it.
And the characters are snide and they make catty remarks and they're.
And terrible choices.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
Love it.
And that's what it is. So here is the cast with A Weekend in the Country.
Look, ma'am, an invitation here, ma'am, delivered by hand. Ma'am, I noticed the stationery's engraved and very grand. Petra, how too exciting, just when I need it. Petra, such elegant writing, so chic, you hardly can read it. What do you think? Who can it be? Even the ink? No, here, let me. Your presence, just think of it, Petra, is kindly. It's at a chateau, requested, etc., etc. Madame Leonora Arms, oh no! A weekend in the country, we're invited. What a horrible plot. A weekend in the country, I'm excited. No, you're not. A weekend in the country, just imagine. It's completely depraved. A weekend in the country, it's insulting. It's engraved. Is that woman, is that arm felt? Tell the actress, or the ghoul. She may hope to make her charm felt, but she's mad if she thinks I would be such a fool as to weekend in the country. How insulting. And I'm nothing to wear. A weekend in the country. Here, the last place I'm going is there. Yes, what an invitation. Yes, who begins with an A? Ah, felt is at a relation to the decrepit Desiree. Yes, when we're asked to go, sir, see, sir, the date there. Yes, where a fancy chateau, sir. Yes, to who's lying in wait there, setting her traps, fixing her face.
Darling, perhaps a change of pace.
Oh, no.
A weekend in the country would be charming and the air would be fresh.
A weekend with that woman.
In the country.
In the flesh.
I've some business with her mother.
See, it's business. Oh, no doubt. But the business with her mother would be hardly the business I'd worry about.
Just a weekend in the country, smelling jasmine.
Watching little things grow.
A weekend in the country.
Go!
My darling will simply say no.
Oh. A weekend.
How very amusing.
A weekend.
But also inept.
A weekend, of course, we're refusing.
Oh, contraire, you must accept.
Oh, no.
A weekend in the country.
But it's frightful.
No, you don't understand. A weekend in the country is delightful if it's planned. Wear your hair down and a flower. Don't use makeup, dress in white. She'll grow older by the hour and be hopelessly shattered by Saturday night. Spend a weekend in the country.
We'll accept it.
I'd a feeling you would. A weekend in the country.
Yes, it's only polite that we should.
Good.
Well?
I've an intriguing little social item.
What?
Out at the Armfelt family manse.
Well, what?
Merely a weekend, still
wanted my diminutive to nose invited to go, this time with his pants.
You don't mean...
I'll give you three guesses.
She wouldn't.
Reduce it to two.
It can't be.
It nevertheless is...
Eggerman.
Right, score one for you.
Aha!
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 A weekend in the country, we should try it.
How I wish we'd been asked.
A weekend in the country, peace and quiet.
We'll go masked.
A weekend in the country.
Uninvited, they'll consider it odd.
A weekend in the country, I'm delighted.
Oh my God.
And the shooting should be pleasant if the weather's not too rough. Happy birthday, it's your present.
But
you haven't been getting out nearly enough. And a weekend in the country.
It's perverted.
Pack my quiver and bow.
A weekend in the country.
Exactly 2:30 we go.
You can't.
We shall.
We shan't.
I'm getting the car and we're motoring down.
Yes, I'm certain you are and I'm staying in town.
I won't.
I should.
Pack everything I own.
You know. I'm thinking it out.
There's no need to shout.
Alright, then we're off and away.
What a beautiful day for a weekend in the country. How amusing. How delightful we go. A weekend in the country while we're losing our control. A weekend in the country, how enchanting, on the manicured lawns. A weekend in the country, with the panting and the yawns. With the crickets and the pheasants, and the orchards and the hay. With the servants and the peasants, we'll be laying our plans when we're playing croquet. For a weekend in the country, so inactive that one has to lie down. A weekend in the country,
the shallow worldly figures, the frivolous lives, the devil's companions know not whom they serve. It might be instructive to observe. A weekend in the country,
So we are almost done with the first six of Amy Spalding's 12 favorite show tunes. And we are going to go out on a high for the first half, so to speak, literally. So what do we have next?
We are going to go to Evita, which is a show that I've loved since I was a teen and I still love. And I really, this is another show where I could have picked, most of these are shows I could have picked a lot of tracks, but I love Rainbow High because I love a hype up song. I love, if we're going to have a track with Patti LuPone, I want her belting. And I want a lot from it. And this is another song I really love to have on in my car and fail to sing along with well. And I should, I also feel like it has to be honored because back in the days when Twitter was good and Twitter existed, RIP, my bio the entire time was just eyes, hair, mouth, figure, dress, voice, style, movement. And so also paying homage to my dearly departed Twitter bio. If you're curious, if people who didn't know the show Evita were like, what is your bio? I'm correct. Everyone asked what it was and I didn't care.
So from the original Broadway cast recording of Evita, here's Patti LuPone with Rainbow High.
I don't really think I need the reasons why I won't succeed.
started. Let's get this show on the road. Let's make it obvious bet on is off and rolling.
I have a vision less voice style.
I came from the people, they need to adorn me. So Christian Dior me, from my head to my toes. I need to be dazzling, I want to be rainbow high. They must have excitement, and so must I. I'm their product, it's vital you sell me. So Machiavelli, me, make an Argentine rose. I need to be thrilling, and I shall be rainbow high. They need their escape, and so do I.
Have a figure, dress, voice, style, movement, and magic. Ring, love, bass, tongue, excitement.
Oh, my descamisados expect me to outshine the enemy. The aristocracy, I won't disappoint them. I'm their savior, that's what they call me. So roll up a coney, anything goes. To make me fantastic, I have to be rainbow high. In magical colors, you're not decorating a girl for a night on the town. And I'm not a second-rate queen getting kicks with a crown.
So we are halfway through Amy Spaulding's 12 favorite show tunes, and we're going to take a quick little break so we can talk about her newest book from Kensington Books. We should give them a shout out. The new book is called In Her Spotlight, and it's book number four, part of the series called Out in Hollywood. The other books are For Her Consideration, At Her Service, and On Her Terms.
But as discussed, read them in whatever order.
Yes, they are not. It's a series of books that all live in the same universe, shall we say.
Exactly.
But they're all standalone books. I read this particular book, which is book number four, enjoyed it immensely. I wasn't sure what I was getting myself into when I read the book. I was like, well, it's a sapphic romantic comedy, so that'll be kind of fun. We'll see what happens. It's set in the world of theater, which we will talk about. But we'll dive into that a little bit more specifically in a minute. But give the listeners a brief synopsis of the story and the characters.
Yeah. In Her Spotlight is about Tess Gardner, who is sort of a Marvel-esque A-list actress who's gotten very famous for playing a superhero. This is not what she had set out to really do as an actor. She went to Juilliard. She wants to get back to the stage, be taken more seriously. And so she's been cast in a show that's being developed in Los Angeles and going to be directed by a pretty major theater director. But right before the show begins rehearsals, a scandal breaks with him. And so he's out, and they have brought in a female director sort of last minute. And it turns out that is the very closeted Tess's secret ex-girlfriend from Summer Stock Theater about a dozen years ago. And now they are working together on this play.
Yes. And they had a very tumultuous split up, so to speak.
Yeah. Sort of was.
They don't really tell you. You don't really reveal. You're very smart to not really reveal exactly what happened until as the story progresses, you kind of give us a little bit of flashbacks as to what really happened. And I thought you handled it really, really well. Because a lot of this distress is in Tess's mind. And when Rebecca, and she talks to Rebecca about it, it's not such a big deal. That's always how it is for everybody. It's sort of like you work it all up in your head, you know?
Yeah, you hold on to things from your past and other people hold on to them in different ways, or maybe don't hold on to them at all.
Right.
Which I also was something I wanted to, think about, and, you know, what space does this, for two women who went through this big thing 12 years ago, what space is it still taking up in their minds?
Right, exactly. And it's, talk about the whole concept of the setting, because it's sort of Center Theater Group.
Yes.
Basically.
I feel like I'm really not even trying to hide it, but it's funny how many people are like, oh, it's like, it's either completely made up or it's based on Pasadena Playhouse or
really
Geffen. I'm just like, no, guys, it is. I feel like, I mean, it is CTG.
You literally, I mean, they really don't. Are these people who live in LA who are saying this?
I think sometimes it's like they've read part of it and because
you've literally, when you describe it, I think you even literally describe the fact that the complex is made up of three different theaters.
Yeah, I do. And yeah, exactly.
You do. And it's like, because we all know the Center Theater Group, the complex downtown has three different theaters. There's the Dorothy Chandler and the Mark Taper and the Amundsen.
It's also literally it's located a block from the Broad and Mocha. And I'm that's where that is.
It's, you know, you don't call it what it is, but it's, you know, basically downtown, and it's the big theater downtown. But I talk about the research you did, because I saw many familiar names in the acknowledgments of local theater people that I know. So talk about what research you did.
So I love theater. I've loved theater my whole life. My parents took us to theater when I was growing up, and I did a little assistant stage managing when I was in college, but I really never worked in theater, much less, this is a very professional production. This is a show that is basically, you know, premiering at my version of the Amundsen that is, you know, ideally headed to Broadway. And so I've never been a part of a production like this. And when I went to start writing, I realized I couldn't even really outline it because I didn't know how long is the rehearsal process. At what point are they doing this? At what point are they doing that? What does this take up? What is this? And so I thought, I've just got to start talking to people and learning. And I'm really fortunate. I have a lot of theater friends and acquaintances and people who are willing to chat with me. And so I just started talking to people. Sometimes I would ask really specific questions about timing, about schedules and rehearsal process. And sometimes I would just, you know, let them talk about, you know, what are stresses that have come up? Like, what are things you worry about when you're doing this? Like, what is the most exciting part? What is the scariest part? And just trying to, you know, in my head, I sort of had an idea of what the story would be like. And the more I talked to people, it really kind of shifted it, because one thing that I learned very quickly is, for the most part, you know, everyone is now used to celebrities coming into productions. I feel like when I was younger, anytime you'd hear about a celebrity being in a play, it was sort of like, it was ridiculous. People laughed at it. You felt like there's probably some tension. And there's just so much less of that because it's so common now. And so I thought I really thought this would be like a giant source of tension. And it feels like it's just like a minor source of tension. Mm-hmm. And it was a good thing to sort of learn early on and, you know, shift my level of thinking about how Tess would be received in a cast.
Right.
Especially if she was someone who was hardworking and trying to get things done.
Right. Well, but I think you cover that really well because the nice thing is that you, instead of having her coming into the cast of like a big musical where you have like a lot of people, you have her coming into the cast of a small show with a small cast, basically. You only have four other actors in the show.
Yeah, that was very intentional because my editor was already like, Amy, there's so many characters in this book. I'm like, no, I know, but she's like, do you have to list the dramaturg? I was like, yes, I have to list the dramaturg. Yeah. Like, do you need this person too? I was like, you know, you need all these people. You have to at least acknowledge that they're there. This is important.
Right.
So I was like, I cannot also have a giant cast where there's people we don't even know about.
Right.
I went with a smaller cast.
Right. But that's, I think that ultimately helps you in a lot of ways, because with Tess's entry into the cast as a quote unquote movie star, and especially because she's the nice thing is not only she's a movie star, but she's a movie star of comic book movies. You know what I mean? She's sort of like she's not like a real actress.
No,
she's,
no one takes her seriously.
Right. But the nice
she's walking in.
Right. But the nice part is you have a nice diverse cast who can all have very diverse opinions about her, because you have like Michael, who is like the most negative about her. And you have, but and then the rest of the cast are, they have different levels of acceptance.
Yes.
Which gives you a nice breadth of what she has to deal with.
Yeah. Pretty early on, I was like, she can't come in and have everyone hate her. That's not even
because that's not realistic either.
It's not realistic, exactly. And
the younger members of the cast seem to be the ones who are like, don't care as much. They don't care.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, it's like the old guard are the ones who are like, you know, she's not a real star. She's not a real actress.
I really wanted Michael to represent that. I thought, I was like, that is such a person that exists. I know that. We all know that person.
Yeah.
We've all, in some ways, probably been that person a little in our own lives about something. Mm-hmm. And I mean, I honestly loved writing Michael. I love that he sort of comes off as
a
villain.
Character.
And he's, to me, he's got a certain way of looking at things.
Yeah.
And I don't know. I had a blast writing him.
Yeah. I thought he was a great character. I really did. Because I thought he showed such a great arc in the story. And where he begins and where he ends in the book, I'm not going to give a whole lot away, but where he begins and ends in the book is really nice to watch with and the way he works with her.
Yeah, I think one thing I love to watch things about and then also write things about is people collaborating who mm-hmm. like to work and like to work hard and really care about what they're doing. Mm-hmm. And I think it was, for me, really fun to sort of like test these characters in, you know, what they thought they were going to get out of something and what mm-hmm. they were actually going to get out of it. Mm-hmm. It was helpful too in doing the research that like I don't think I necessarily have the highest opinion of comic book movies all the time myself. I've seen some of them, but not most of them. And I certainly, when I was writing, it was like, oh, she probably hates this. It's like beneath her, but it's like the thing that makes the money and like makes her famous. And that was just not the experience I had in talking to anyone who's involved in actual Marvel products, which was just that there's a lot of joy that goes into it. These are movies that are saving people's lives. Not all of them. Some of them are obviously not very good. But that there is such a there's such a positive quality to this, not just the money aspect. And that really made me take a step back and was like, yeah, she does like this. She just also wants people to take her seriously. And she doesn't want to do this one thing for the rest of her life.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I thought that was really interesting because you take a moment to get that message across in the book through Tess.
And that was really, that's something that came from, you know, I think when people think of research, they think of the specific things like how long would the table read last? When is tech start? All of that. And that was obviously important too. But research also gave me things like, just like, oh, there's a lot of positives about this thing that I look on negatively. Mm-hmm. Let's make sure that's covered. And so I just feel really fortunate that people were so willing to be generous with their time.
Yeah. And also I wanted to talk a little bit about the dedication in the book.
Yeah.
Which is I loved your dedication, which I'm going to read because I thought it was really, really terrific. And it is to all the theater kids and all the Midwestern queers, and especially where that Venn diagram overlaps, this one's for you. You want to talk about that for a second?
Yeah. You know, writing this, when I started thinking about this book, because Tess is a character who's mentioned very slightly in the first two books in the series, as an actress who is like publicly straight, but like my other two main characters were definitely like, I don't know, she has a vibe, who knows? And so I knew I was obviously going to write it. If I was going to write her story, she was closeted. Mm. And I hadn't really grappled with what that meant in as far as it's not, you know, it's not just like fun, whimsical sneaking around. It is that she has cut off a part of herself and that she is hiding from it. She's been on the run from it for years. And now that she's sort of like staying in one place, working on the show, seeing Rebecca every day. And also the way that theater opens you up because of the intimate way you have to work with the rest of your cast mm-hmm. and the creative team, that she is unable to keep running the way she had been and maybe doesn't want to keep running. And thinking about the kind of person this would be, to me, it wasn't as simple as just, she knows that Hollywood doesn't want a certain thing from a certain kind of star. I thought it, I don't think that explains it all. I think it is that she also probably grew up somewhere where it wouldn't have been easily accepted mm-hmm. and that she probably comes from a conservative family or at least parents who would not have supported her. And so thinking so, and you know, I grew up in Missouri. Tess is from Illinois in the book. And because I usually try to pick somewhere at least nearby that I can. I'm like, I know what it's like to grow up in this general area. So I have a bit of that background, too. And really thinking about what that would have felt like to her. And, you know, the joy when you find the connection and community in theater and community in queer chosen family and sort of all the people who will be there to support you and all the people. One thing that's been a real joy for me is that as an adult who moved from Missouri to Los Angeles, I've actually found so much acceptance from, you know, my community in Missouri. And I'm always sort of like, oh, I never knew I could have that. It's sort of that feeling of like, well, you can move away and go to a big city and then you can find people who understand you more. And to feel like so much understanding and acceptance from where you're from feels so special.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, thinking about all of that as I wrote this book, it was like not simple enough to dedicate it to theater kids or people, you know, other queer people from the Midwest. It was like, it's everyone. And it's a lot of us. It's all those things. So, yeah, it meant a lot to me.
Yeah. And I also really liked that you, because I wanted people to realize that not only is it covering Tess's theater life and all the characters, there's a lot of characters involved in the theater stuff. But there's also a lot of characters involved in her professional life because
yes.
You've got her whole team of the publicists and the agent and all the, you know, all those people that are kind of running everything and almost in a way running her.
Running her, yeah.
Really out of control. But you also have her family life. You have her best friend and her brother, who are
yes.
her dog, who are her most important people.
Yes, those three I think are the most important when the book starts.
They're most important. And she's not even really she's not really honest with them either.
No,
which is really really surprising. And I also kind of was going to ask you, and you just brought it up. I was going to ask you if Tess was actually mentioned in any of the other earlier books.
Yeah, yeah.
Because I was kind of curious as to whether or not she pops up anywhere at all.
Well, in Max's book, she is a subplot in that that is when she starts to want to take her career seriously. And Max is sort of the only one at that point in an assistant role who's like, yeah, I want to advocate for you in this way.
Right.
But also is like, yes, take a role that pays no money. It's worth it for your feelings. And, you know, that's not always how the rest of Hollywood.
Right. But yeah. But it's very interesting to explore the home life.
Yeah.
Her home life, which is very normal. And in some ways, you cover it. It's a little, it's kind of sad because, you know, you do cover the concept that she can't go out in public very easily because of
yeah.
who she is. And she has a very nice home in a nice, I wouldn't say she's not in Beverly Hills or Bel Air. She's in like Silver Lake.
No, she's in Los Feliz.
Los Feliz, yeah. Silver Lake area. And it's nice, but it's quiet and, you know.
Yeah.
Secluded.
And I think that was really what was dawning on me the idea of like when you're writing someone who is like shut down this one part of her life to the extent that she can't even think about it, like what else has she given up? And then you add fame on top of that and it's really isolating.
Yeah. She doesn't really have much of a life.
Yeah.
Ultimately. But I love the fact, because I think all of us who have been in theater, you're 100% right. When you start to work in theater is what the way she does have to work on this show, you are so exposed in theater that you suddenly realize you can no longer hide.
Yeah.
It's impossible.
Yeah. And I really wanted it to be about sort of all of that, because obviously, you know, spoiler alert for those of you who don't normally read romance, romantic comedy, et cetera, like her and Rebecca are obviously going to reconnect. But I wanted really that opening up to not just be because of, you know, her love story beginning again with Rebecca, but because of the work that goes into theater, the intimacy within a cast, the way that if you're going to do good work on stage, you have to be so open and vulnerable.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
And like, you can't run from yourself when you're trying to access that much of it every
right.
day.
Exactly. And I think I read somewhere either in an interview you did, because I do my homework and I tried to
good job.
Read some of your other interviews and listen to interviews you've done. You tend to like happy endings.
I love happy endings.
And that's what you like to write. And it's so nice. It's refreshing because we're also used to reading, you know, LGBTQ books that are tragic and, you know,
yes.
horrible endings and sad. And it's nice
or like
to
you
have
get a happy ending,
happy
but there's a
comedy.
lot there's a lot, I think, where I was reading where like something good would happen, but then like so much was lost in the getting there.
Yeah. And but your book is, it's fun. It's a fun read. It's a fun read, but it's, the characters are all very real and there's so much to relate to, even if you've never done theater, you've never done Hollywood. There is so much to relate to with these people that it's a really enjoyable read.
Thank you. That is always my goal, because whether or not, I mean, probably no one reading it is going to be in the exact position of Tess, who is, again, a very famous, successful person. But I think we've all had things we've tried to hide from people we care about. I think there's all things we've grappled with that we're not ready for. And I think there's all situations we've come into that have allowed us to grow and move beyond where we maybe thought we could end up. And that was, it was really important for me that like the happy ending in this one, I mean, in all the books that I write, but especially because this is sort of like so big with someone of, you know, immense fame and doing things on sort of like a very public level, that I just really wanted all of the pieces of her happy ending to feel very earned.
Yes, exactly. And it's a very satisfying ending. And I won't give it away. I won't give it away because there is a little bit of surprises at the end, and I won't give it away.
Yeah, I mean, especially because this is the last one in the series. I really wanted to sort of have a, you know, like a series finale feeling at the end where you get, you know, you get, I don't know, see some people from other books. You get, you know, a lot of some callbacks within the book itself. I had a lot of fun writing that sort of like last sequence.
Yes. Well, now I have to go back and read the other three books because I need to know more about some of these people. I was like, I need to know more about these people.
Yeah, I do think if you've read them all that I think it is the most rewarding, but again, it will hold up otherwise.
Yes, absolutely. Yes, I enjoyed it immensely. So with that, let's get back to your final six in your 12 favorite show tunes. And we are, after all the happiness and joy and romantic comedy, we're now up to some drum and strang, right?
Yeah, we are. You know what? I mean, does Les Mis, I guess, probably, does it have the highest body count in musical theater? It might.
Probably. Well, maybe Titanic.
Oh, yeah. I mean, good point. Les Mis is another show that I've liked since I was a kid. This was like my parents' favorite musical, so we went to see it a lot.
Uh-huh.
It's probably one of the shows I've seen the most. But there's a lot of really beautiful songs in Les Mis. Les Mis is another show where I love all of it. And I think it also, you know, shows that come in your life when you're young, they hold a very special place. But I'm going with a track, Confrontation, because this is the best song to sing in your car, especially if you were with someone else who was willing to be the Valjean to your Javert. I should also say that my father loved Javert as a character so much. He loved every time we would go to see it, he was there for Javert. And really, especially just like that character was very important to him. You know what? He was a boomer. He was not going to go to therapy and find out why he related to Javert so much as I might have. But because of this, ever since my dad passed away, Javert has taken on like even more meaning to me because I'm like, this is my connection to my father, which means I always want to pick a Javert track. So, but instead of going with Stars, which some might have, I think Confrontation is fun to sing. I clearly love an action song. So yeah, let's do it.
Here is Terrence Mann and Colm Wilkinson from the original Broadway cast of Les Mis.
Valjean, at last, we see each other plain. Monsieur Le May, you'll wear a different chain.
Before you say another word, Javert, before you chain me up like a slave again, listen to me, there is something I must do. This woman leaves behind a suffering child. There is none but me who can intercede. In mercy's name, 3 days are all I need. Then I'll return. I pledge my word, then I'll return.
You must think me mad. I've hunted you across the years. Men like you can never change. A man such as you.
Believe me. Like you. And what you will change. There is a duty that I'm sworn to do.
No,
you know nothing
two
of my life.
Or my
steal
My duties to the law. You have no rights. Come with me to the 601. Now the fool has turned around. Just a Jean Valjean is nothing now.
I am warning you, Javert. I'm a stronger man by far. There is power in me yet. My race is not yet run.
Jesus, wait. You know nothing of Javert. I was born inside a jail. I was born to kill my kill. I am from the gutter too.
And this I swear to you tonight.
There is no place for you to hide.
Your child will live within my care.
Wherever you may hide away.
And I will raise her to the light. I swear to you, I will be there.
So, Amy, what are we doing next?
Next, we're going to do a track from Chicago. Chicago is another, I'll just say, another show where I think like a lot of the cast recordings, I like a lot of the people, but not all of the people. And I wish there was like a perfect version for me. But there's no one as perfect as Jerry Orbach in general. So his Billy Flynn is one of my favorites. I love characters that are like a flim flam man. I love... I was talking to a friend about my list and she was trying to guess. And I said, oh, from Chicago, I picked a song for extroverts with bad self-esteem. And she was like, oh, Roxy. And I was like, oh, I guess there's a lot of songs about extroverts with bad self-esteem in Chicago because I actually picked Razzle Dazzle. It's another like Rainbow High, a hype up song for me. I love this one so much, but mainly any track with Jerry Orbach is always going to make me really happy.
It's all show business, kid. These trials, the whole world, show business. But, kid, you're working with a star. The biggest.
Give 'em the old razzle dazzle, razzle dazzle 'em. Give 'em an act with lots of flash in it. And the reaction will be passionate. Give 'em the old hocus pocus, bead and feather 'em. How can they see with sequins in their eyes? What if your hinges all are rusting? What if, in fact, you're just disgusting? Razzle dazzle 'em, and they'll never catch wise.
Give 'em the old razzle dazzle, razzle dazzle 'em. Back since the days of old Methuselah. Everyone loves the big bamboozler. Give 'em the old three-ring circus, sun and stagger on. When you're in trouble, go into your dance. Though you are stiffer than a girder, they let you get away with me.
Sorcerer you are.
to keep them way off balance. How can they spot you got no talents?
Razzle dazzle up.
Razzle dazzle up.
Razzle dazzle up.
And they'll make you a star.
From the original Broadway cast recording of Chicago by Kandron Ebb, we just heard Jerry Auerbach with Razzle Dazzle. And next up, we have an interesting choice.
I feel like this is a real, like, this is the most jarring transition, I feel like, in the probably, in my
yes,
lineup.
Probably. Yes, probably. So where are we going next?
We're going to go underground into a cave in Kentucky and do a song from Floyd Collins, a show that I've loved since the 90s. And I've never, I saw like a local production in St. Louis at, my gosh, I can't think of what Scott Miller's theater company is called. But anyway, so I have seen this staged, and I unfortunately was in New York like 2 weeks before the revival opened last year and was not able to see it. But I was blown away by this cast recording. Like I said about Ragtime, when you've loved something for a really long time and you have like a very like deeply engraved version of the one you've been listening to for decades, and then you hear a different version and you love it, it is, I just think, one of the, it's like one of the beautiful things we have about musical theater, that people can go in and do something again and bring new life to it. And that is how I felt about this Floyd Collins cast recording. I initially on my list had The Call. That song is like 9 minutes long. Then I was going to do The Riddle song. That song is like 8 minutes long. So I was like, let's do the Ballad of Floyd Collins reprise, which I just think is just one of these songs that stands on its own as just really beautiful and really telling quite a story.
So here is Cole Vaughn from the recent Broadway cast recording of Floyd Collins.
The air was cold and the ground was wet. I was just as muddy as a man could get. Hadn't any light but a little oil lantern. It got you in so tight that you know you can't turn back. I was slipping around on my belly and knees. I could feel my fingertips about to freeze. I could almost see where the prisoner lay, just about to holler when I heard him pray. Oh my Lord, have mercy on my soul. Don't let me die alone in this dark hole. And when my Savior is at hand, I'll be sure to meet him on top of the land. I won't go digging round in the hollows and holes. I'm gonna leave it up to the hogs and moles. Never set another foot inside a cave if I make it out of this lonesome grave. And there he remains all alone in a cold Kentucky hillside. There he remains all alone in a cold Kentucky hillside. He was laying still like he was dead, water trickling down on top his head. 7 whole days he hadn't had a crumb. His eyes were sunk and wearisome. He swallowed what I had right out of my hand. Then he took some coffee from an old tin can. I told him we would soon dig him out of this place, and a little smile goes across his face. He said, boy, thank God that you are here. Now I know my rescue is near. And when my time comes to die, I'll be sure to do it where I can see sky. I won't go digging round in the hollows and holes. I'ma leave it up to the hogs and moles. Never set another foot inside a cave if I make it out of this lonesome grave. And there he remains all alone in a cold Kentucky hillside. And there he remains all alone in a cold Kentucky hillside.
So next up, we have another off-Broadway show that moved to Broadway very successfully and won lots of Tony Awards. And we have Fun Home, right?
Yes. I was going to pick Fun Home anyway, but especially when you're here to talk about a sapphic romance, I feel like you've got to include Fun Home. But I would no matter what, because I love Fun Home. I'm very lucky that I saw it at the Public and then saw it a bunch of times on Broadway and on tour because I love the show so much. First of all, it's wonderful. Everything about it, I think, is wonderful. The performances and that original cast, you know, the score, lyrics, the book, love all of it. I think queer women, we've been waiting to have a show. And what a gift to have Fun Home, which is, you know, at times very, very tragic and also really joyous. And I picked one of the really joyous songs for mine, which is Changing My Major, which is... I love this song so much. The first time I saw it was obviously before there was a cast recording or anything. And so I was going in. I'd read the graphic memoir years ago, but was just going in blind. And oh my gosh, the delight this song brought in me.
So we're going to hear Emily Skeggs from the Broadway cast recording singing Changing My Major from Fun Home.
What happened last night? Are you really here? Joan, 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 Joan. Hi, Joan! Don't wake up, Joan! Oh my God, last night. Oh my God, oh my God, oh my God, oh my God, last night. I got so excited, I was too enthusiastic. Thank you for not laughing. Well, you laughed a little bit at one point when I was touching you and said I might lose consciousness, which you said was adorable, and I just have to trust that you don't think I'm an idiot or some kind of an animal. I never lost control due to overwhelming lust, but I must say that I'm changing my major to Joan. I'm changing my major to sex with Joan. I'm changing my major to sex with Joan, with a minor in kissing Joan. Foreign study to Joan's inner thighs, a seminar on Joan's ass in her Levi's, and Joan's crazy brown eyes. Joan, I feel like Hercules. Oh God, that sounds ridiculous. Just keep on sleeping through this and I'll work on calming down. So by the time you've woken up, I'll be cool, I'll be collected, and I'll have found some dignity. But who needs dignity? 'Cause this is so much better. I'm radiating happiness. Will you stay here with me for the rest of the semester? We won't need any food. We'll live on sex alone. Sex with Joan. Writing a thesis on Joan. It's a cutting edge field and my mind is blown. I will gladly stay up every night to hone my compulsory skills with Joan. I will study my way down her spine, familiarize myself with her well-made outline while she researches mine. I don't know who I am. I've become someone new. Nothing I just did is anything I would do. Overnight, everything changed. I am not prepared. I'm dizzy, I'm nauseous, I'm shaky. I'm scared. Am I falling into nothingness or flying into something so sublime? I don't know, but I'm changing my major.
the pillow, so sweet, all sweaty and tangled up in my bedsheet. And my heart feels complete. Let's never leave this room. How about we stay here till finals? I'll go to school forever. I'll take out a dementedly huge high-interest loan. 'Cause I'm changing my major to John.
One of the best things about Fun Home is not only is it a great show, but also that it was so successful.
Yes,
that's what I love. I thought it was such a I think everybody seemed to think that it was going to be such a niche show.
Yes.
There was going to be such a limited audience, but it proved to be so successful, and then even got a tour, and was so successful on tour, and is still being mounted all over the country. It's because it's more than just a lesbian themed show.
Yes,
it's a family story. And it's tragic, but also funny and also real. And I think it touches a lot of people.
Yeah, I really think so. I remember when I saw it at the Public, when the lights came on after the curtain call, I heard all this like really loud sniffling, like people really trying to get themselves together. And I was like turning around to stand up and walk out. And it was all like men mm-hmm. with their wives who were crying. Mm-hmm. And I was like, oh, this is not where I thought the crying was all coming from. But I do think there's a lot, no matter who you are, to grapple with in that show about your past, about your family, about the legacy we leave behind, and regardless of like who you are and what your story is.
Yeah, I agree. I think it's one of those shows that is so deceptive because on the surface, it just looks like this small family.
This one very specific thing, and it's so big.
Yeah, and it's so not.
Yeah.
It's got such universal themes.
Yes.
It's got a lot more going to it for it than you realize. So now we're going to a show with a lot of really big themes and a lot of really loud music. So what is next?
Oh, I am here with one of the loudest songs in the show. Yes. Yeah, I want to do a song from Chess, a show that, it's weird to say a show I love because I do love Chess. Also, has there ever been a production of it that was like correct? Who could say? Everyone's trying their best.
There's a good cast recording I will recommend to you.
Okay.
Yeah. Do you have a favorite cast recording?
Actually, the Broadway cast recording is my favorite one. It's the one I came in on.
Oh,
and
okay.
I have always loved it. I know it is not the most, I think most people go original London concept, but I really love this one.
Okay.
I did see the revival and that cast sings the hell out of it. And I am excited for when I will be absolutely listening to the new one when it is released. But look, I love Judy Kuhn as Florence. Mm-hmm. No one will ever top her. I mean, David Carroll, RIP,
oh,
like
God.
What a
amazing voice.
One of the most beautiful voices we've ever had on Broadway.
Yeah, absolutely. So what did we pick?
Oh, we did Nobody's Side.
Oh, yes. So we're going to hear Judy Kuhn from Chess singing Nobody's Side.
What's going on around me is barely making sense. I need some explanations fast. I see my present partner in the imperfect tense, and I don't see how we can last. I feel I need a change of cast. They're getting harder to believe. I know this can't continue. I still have a lot to prove. There must be more.
achieve. But I don't have the nerve to leave. Everybody's playing the game, but nobody's rules are the same. Nobody's on nobody's side. Better learn to go it alone. Recognize you're out on your own. Nobody's on nobody's side. The one I should not think of keeps rolling through my mind, and I don't want to let that go. No lovers ever faithful, no contract truly signed. There's nothing certain left to know. And how the cracks begin to show. Never make
So if you are a chess aficionado, I am going to make a recommendation. I don't think it's available on Spotify, but I can probably send it to you. Maybe it is. I don't think it's on Spotify. But the most, I know a lot of people are, I came in on chess with the London concept recording.
Yeah.
That's where I came in. So the Broadway cast recording for me was sort of like, I kind of screwed around with it. But the Danish cast recording is the one that's actually closest to the London production.
Ooh.
Yes. And it's all sung in English. It's Emma Kershaw plays Florence, and Stig Rossen plays Anatoly. And it's a 2-CD set, and it's all done in English. And it is the closest to what was on stage in London in terms of the song order. And there's songs in it that are not on the original London recording, the London concept recording.
I'm very intrigued.
It's really wonderful because it gives you all the missing pieces. So it's literally the most complete in terms of what was on stage in London. So you'll have to track it down. If you don't have it, I can easily.
Okay. Yeah. I'm going to try to track it down, but I'll be in touch.
I will send it to you because I have it. I can send it to you somehow. Anyway, fantastic. So we'll get that to you because it's really a wonderful listen because you get to hear the.
No, I would love to hear that.
Yeah. It's really good. Anyway, so we're up to your 12th.
Yeah.
Your 12 favorites. So where are we going for the final one?
This is another exception you let me make from a soundtrack because it is an adaptation. You know, I do have two Andrew Lloyd Webber tracks on this, and I have two Sondheim, and I feel like that's a nice balance and says a lot about me. You know, I grew up listening to musicals in the 80s. I was very much an Andrew Lloyd Webber person, and then, you know, discovered Sondheim as I got older and met more, musical theater aficionados who were sort of like pointing me in new directions. But man, I love an Andrew Lloyd Webber song, and I think his early stuff is the best. I think Jesus Christ Superstar, track for track, Jesus Christ Superstar, I think is phenomenal. And another show I've seen a lot, and I ended up going with the soundtrack just because I really wanted to have Carl Anderson's version of Superstar, though I often listen to the London cast, the London concept album where it's Murray Head. So I feel like I there's a lot of Judases I enjoy. So
that's interesting.
No, it, you know, it's like
there's
my
a lot
father
of
was
Judases I enjoy.
It's like me and my, you know, my dad was Javert, me and Judas. I feel like this is where we connect. But it's Judas' show. I mean, the song he's got the best songs.
He does.
And I also the thing I really like about Jesus Christ Superstar is it's written for believers and non-believers, and at the end of the day is a little bit about what happens when your friend starts acting really weird.
Well, and I will say you are forgiven for your Andrew Lloyd Webber stuff because you're picking the Tim Rice era.
Yes, and that Tim is fair.
And that's fair. See, and I'm a big fan of the Tim Rice era material,
and I
much
meant
more
to also,
so than post-Tim Rice. And you just had two Tim Rice shows in a row. So there you go. See? You just had Chess, which is Tim Rice. And you have Jesus Christ Superstar, which is Tim Rice. And you had Evita, which was Tim Rice.
For all of these shows, Evita, Chess, and Jesus Christ Superstar, Tim Rice gets into also one of my favorite topics, obviously, which is fame. He obviously loves writing about fame. He loves writing about image. Mm-hmm. And I think some of his most fun lyrics about that are in Superstar.
Yes. So here is Carl Anderson from the original motion picture soundtrack of Jesus Christ Superstar with Superstar.
You, I don't understand why you let the things you did get so out of hand. You'd have managed better if you'd had it planned. Now why'd you choose such a backward time in such a strange land? If you'd come today, you could have reached the whole nation. This little poor BC had no mass communication. Don't you get me wrong? Don't you get me wrong?
Jesus Christ, who are you born? Have you said?
So there you have it. We've just listened to Amy Spaulding's 12 favorite show tunes as of the moment. It could change tomorrow or next week, which we'll have to have her back so she can redo her 12. Anyway, she also talked about in depth in her spotlight, her fourth and what she now says is her final book of the Out in Hollywood series of books, which I highly recommend. I read this fourth book and loved it. And I now want to go back and read the other three for her consideration at her service and on her terms. I think they sound like they're all great. I loved the new one in her spot.
Thank you so much.
So much fun to read. So congratulations on the new book.
Thank you.
I will include a link to Kensington Books to the In Her Spotlight page so people can purchase the book. It has all sorts of links on the page. I checked it out.
Yeah, wherever you want to get it from, yeah. Once you land there, you can go.
Yeah, you can land there and it takes you to all the different places you can buy the book. And you have a website. Where can people see you?
It's theamyspaulding.com, which is a terrible URL to say aloud. It's just theamyspaulding.
Yes, I will include
Spaulding include like the link. Basketball.
Yes, I'll include the link on the webpage also. So, Amy, it's been delightful chatting with you.
This has been wonderful.
I'm so glad you were able to come on the show, and much success with the book, which is now out, just came out. So people, you should find it.
Look for it in
Wherever books are sold. And do you have a preference where people should buy it? If you have a
preference? No, I think you should buy it wherever is best for you. If you really are like, no, I will go out of my way to get, like, I always say, like, support the local independent bookstore in your community. Not every community has one. There's a Barnes & Noble, great. If, like, you're like, look, I just need to order it from Amazon. That's fine. Get it where it's easy for you.
Yes, get it wherever it's easiest to get it. Just get it.
Yeah, support, especially in these unprecedented times, et cetera, supporting queer artists, supporting other marginalized artists, like, is really important. And when you can do that by buying their work, by going to see their shows, et cetera, it really does matter. And with books, that's something, financially, we don't all have unlimited budgets. I get that. Like, just even requesting it from your library means they order a copy. It puts my book in more places, in front of more people. That all helps us.
Great. So, Amy, again, thank you so, so much.
Thank you so much for having me. Getting to talk about show tunes for an hour is my dream.